Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Dr. Jill Stein. She's seeking the Green Party nomination for President of the United States, and so far, she's winning. Jill's a doctor of internal medicine, and she has previously run as a Green Party candidate for Governor of Massachusetts, Secretary of State of Massachusetts, and State Representative. Jill, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Grant. Great to be here.
Well, I think we can agree that the chances are not great that you'll be taking the oath of office next January. So I wanted to start by asking you to tell me, what are the broader aims of your campaign?
Recent polls have shown in no uncertain terms that people are not happy with the options that they have, that large numbers are calling for a third party, saying that they would vote for a third party, 49% in a recent Washington Post poll. So I wouldn't rule things out. Certainly the odds are against it, but I'd say at the same time, hold on to your hat and let's see where it goes. That said, in my mind, to win this is to basically regain a voice for everyday people who've been locked out of the political process, and actually to look back over the history of progressive politics, whether it was the abolition of slavery or women's right to vote or the right to form a union and have decent wages and safe working conditions. All of those achievements have depended on having an independent political party which could drive those issues forward in the political conversation. And I think we're in a whole new ballpark now where people realize that this politics of fear that has really confined people to the two-party system, that politics of fear is not serving us well, that silence is not an effective political strategy, and that we've got to answer the politics of fear with the politics of courage and actually stand up for what we need and where we want to go. That, in my view, is a victory, whether we are 2% of the vote or 52% of the vote. It's about reclaiming our political voice, which is essential if we're to get our democracy back on track.
To get more specific about this, is the hope of the party in your campaign to move the Democratic Party and to have an effect on the Democratic Party in some important way?
I think that's the minimum we want to do, and I think that would be very effective if we can force the big business-as-usual parties to embrace a Green New Deal, to support the concept of eliminating unemployment and putting everyone back to work, to support health care as a human right and a Medicare for all system that actually saves us money at the same time that we provide health care to everyone, which is comprehensive and puts consumers, everyday people, back in charge of their health care and their decisions. These are great solutions that the public already supports. Without our voices in the campaign, these issues won't even be on the table. They won't get a mention. They won't have a word in edgewise.
And you mentioned your dissatisfaction and your party's dissatisfaction with the two-party system and both parties. And you've been quite critical of both the Republicans and the Democrats, and you've been critical of President Obama. So I wanted to follow up on that piece. What are your biggest criticisms of the Obama administration?
Where do we begin? When he was elected into office, people thought that they were going to have an advocate for everyday people. But what were his first actions? He invited in Larry Summers, the guy who created the Wall Street crisis back in the Clinton administration, really indicating where this White House was going to fall on the question of Wall Street bailouts. And they bailed out Wall Street, and the president supported this even before he was elected. And at that time, we were talking about an $800 billion bailout, which then went on to become a $16 trillion bailout in free loans and giveaways. This has been devastating to our economy. He certainly hasn't stood up for working people. He ran on the idea that he was going to support, workers' rights to organize, and he was nowhere to be found. That legislation just fell off the table. He renewed free trade agreements and expanded free trade agreements, which have drastically undermined the capacity of workers to bargain and to support decent wages and benefits here. So he's contributed to the offshoring and the undermining of wages, which have continued to collapse under his watch. And, I've got to mention the war as well. This was going to be the peace president. Why did he withdraw the troops from Iraq on George Bush's withdrawal date? because he couldn't negotiate a security and immunity for the soldiers in Iraq to stay there longer. That's why he came out at George Bush's date of withdrawal. One of his first acts was also to bomb Pakistan, to expand the drone wars into Yemen and Somalia. So, you know, we are not, and to surge the troops into Afghanistan. So on issue after issue, this is a president who has not delivered. And in fact, one of the things that precipitated my running was learning last August that the president was putting Medicare and Social Security on the chopping block and offering that up as the sacrificial lamb for this debt crisis that he could have avoided at the time that he gave in to the renewal of the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. He could have asked something in return. And over again, we've seen this president cave.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Jill Stein, who is seeking the Green Party nomination for U.S. president. I wanted to come back to a couple of the issues that you just brought up there, but let me focus on this one first, and it has to do with the issue of the environment, which is something I think is central to the Green Party message, and I know that it's also important to you based on the things that I've read on your website. I'm curious to hear about your views on the relationship between stewardship of the environment and the desire to encourage economic growth, particularly in the short term, because they often find themselves pitted against each other, at least when others are talking about them. How do you see the relationship?
That last thing you said is key. It's when others are talking about it, that our economic issues and our environmental issues are usually framed as if it's a choice between one and the other. But in fact, for those who actually understand the environment or the economy, you know that one cannot exist without the other. You know, I see this as very similar to my role as a medical doctor. People don't come into the doctor's office saying, I really want my kidneys to do well. Would you please take care of my kidneys and forget about those lungs and that heart? You know, it's kidneys. You know, same thing in the broader, you know, sphere of life, that the environment and our economy have to work hand in hand. We have to have the water to cool our engines and, to cool the plants that are producing energy and so on, to grow our food. Our economic systems very much depend on our environmental supports and vice versa.
Are those two things, though, ever in opposition, the environment and the economy? Are there moments in different contexts where they do become in opposition to each other?
In my view, no. I mean, there are always choices that have to be made, but they are very much, I think, organ systems within the same, you know, within the same circle of life, and both have to work for people. We talk about people and the planet. You know, you can't separate the people from the planet or the planet from the people. There are collaborative solutions that are readily findable. The only ones who, you know, really put their foot down and say, no, it's got to be a choice, are generally the ones who are exploiting the environment and who are making out like bandits while they're doing it. We hear this from nuclear. We hear this from coal. We hear this from fracking, that this is the only way we can get jobs. And what they say is not only misguided, it's just like outright wrong. We actually create many more jobs. In fact, per dollar spent, you create 3 times as many jobs in the renewables and conservation sector than you do in fossil fuels, fracking, and nuclear energy. So it is a win-win.
Well, you have a long response to President Obama's State of the Union address on your website. And in that, there's something related to New York I wanted to ask. You paired Andrew Cuomo with Scott Walker in criticizing the austerity cuts in state budgets as hurting workers, hurting service recipients, and hurting society more generally. And a couple months ago on this program, I challenged a conservative political official with the assertion that we simply can't get our fiscal house in order entirely through spending cuts. So I wanted to ask sort of the opposite version of the question to you. Don't we need to cut some domestic spending going forward and pretty soon? I mean, we can't do this entirely through raising taxes on the wealthy and military cuts, or can we?
We can go a long way by creating a fair tax system and asking millionaires and billionaires to contribute their fair share by taxing offshore tax havens where large, you know, large stashes of cash are protected from paying the taxes they should pay by implementing a Wall Street transaction tax, which would discourage reckless speculation at the same time that it would bring money back into our treasury. So we can go a long way by essentially furthering a fairer tax system. But I agree with you. I mean, I think there are enormous reservoirs of waste that need to be cut. And or shall we say harnessed? And I think the biggest one is healthcare waste. There's enormous waste in healthcare. Witness the fact that in our privatized insurance system, there is massive bureaucratic waste in this incredible insurance bureaucracy. And in fact, a third of every healthcare dollar, so it's about 33 cents out of every dollar you spend as a taxpayer on healthcare, is being spent on paper pushing and basically the bureaucratic tracking of incredible minutia that should never be a part of the healthcare system. So by streamlining that wasteful bureaucracy, we can save an enormous amount of money. And where it needs to be put is into actually expanding healthcare so that we have a comprehensive, streamlined, and efficient healthcare system that covers not only acute care but also chronic care, mental health, pharmaceuticals, eye care, all those things that just get cut out of the mix. So this is a win-win. It also saves us trillions of dollars over the coming decade. And you may have heard some economists talking about this, like Dean Baker, for example, talk about needing to reform the waste in healthcare and especially the medical inflation that comes with the private system. It's that medical inflation which is the biggest driver in rising costs of healthcare. It's actually not the aging of the population or the fact that we're getting sicker. Both of those things are happening, but that's not the real driver of rising costs. It's actually plain old-fashioned medical inflation, which goes away under single-payer systems. So we will save trillions of dollars simply from moving to a single-payer system. And then there's one other thing we can do in healthcare, which I would call out-and-out waste. That is the neglect of prevention, of upstream care, and particularly beyond care, just upstream healthy communities. As we integrate a healthy economy and into a healthy green economy into our communities, what does that mean above all for health? It means you have a healthy transportation system. So like Copenhagen, 40% of people bike to work. Why can't we be biking to work and just walking to school and biking to school and so on if we have an active transportation system together with a healthy, organic, local food system, a sustainable food system? That right there basically saves us trillions of dollars. And in fact, the statistics on this that are this: 75% of every healthcare dollar right now is being spent on chronic diseases that are avoidable, that are preventable at a fraction of the cost if we do the right things. And this is where our New Green Deal comes in, because it creates jobs in exactly those areas that create not only a healthy environment, but healthy communities, so that our health expenditures go way down because we are eating healthy and we're transporting healthy, so that we can prevent the vast preponderance, actually, of diseases that we're currently going broke trying to fix.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is the Green Party presidential candidate, Jill Stein. Well, let me ask the elephant in the room question. Let's suppose the presidential election appears to be tight going into the fall. Let's suppose it looks like it could even be as close as 2000, or in terms of the Electoral College votes, 2004. Won't that be a particularly tough sell for you among liberal voters who are obviously your main constituency? They won't want to have another Bush v. Gore experience. So how are you planning on handling that?
I think we are answering the politics of fear with the politics of courage. And when we say that the politics of fear has brought us everything we were afraid of, you know, that's really what the facts on the ground are all about, that if we abandon our values in this democracy and we just vote based on fear of avoiding the worst guy in the room, well, it turns out the guy that was second worst in the room adopts the policies of the guy that was the worst in the room. So if we have a corporate-driven political system, what you see is what you get, and we just keep lurching to the right, and that's what we'll keep on doing. We need to establish a counterweight to this surge into the corporate agenda. How do we do that? We've got to bring democracy back. It's not democracy. It's not the voice of the people. Unless we're in the mix. Without us, it is more corporate-sponsored campaign spin. And I will say, as someone who ran against Mitt Romney in 2002, he was saying pretty much the same thing back then that he is now. But, you know, at the end of the day, he was indistinguishable from Deval Patrick, our poster child of a progressive Democrat who came after him. Nothing changed, nada, because at the end of the day, the policies of, well, shall we say, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, there are shades of gray difference, but they're not different enough that we're going to get a healthcare system that we can afford that's not going to drive us in bankruptcy. They're not different enough that we're going to save the climate. The climate is going down, you know, hell in a handbasket right now under the policies of Barack Obama, who's just adopted drill, baby, drill, who just interfered with the climate accords in Durban so that we're not going to have an international agreement until it's too late in 2020. I mean, this is why, in my view, we don't have time to wait. We're still going to bail out the banks. You know, who did the biggest bailouts? This was Obama's policy, which even trumped that of George Bush. Who expanded the wars in the way that Obama never could have expanded them? I'm sorry, in the way that Bush never could have expanded them. The president, Obama, expanded the wars with a smile, you know, and a friendly face and wonderful inspirational rhetoric, but it got us wars that would have been vehemently protested against if George Bush was in office. And the lesson of the day, look at what happened, for example, with the SOPA legislation, the Stop Online Piracy Act. How did we stop it? We stopped it by people standing up and speaking out and instructing their elected officials that this was an abomination and it should not go forward. That's what should be the driver of our democracy. And by silencing ourselves in the voting booth, you know, we effectively embrace the politics of fear. And we're going to get more of what we're getting. To vote for the same is to get the same. And to go into the voting booth and vote for corporate-sponsored candidates is to give a mandate to 4 more years of corporate rule. In my view, it's not just okay to stand up and vote our values. It's life-saving, and it's what we've got to move to if we want to get our democracy back on track and start building the peaceful, just, green future that we deserve and that is within our reach.
And there's another question that I have to ask you before we get to the questions at the end, and it actually leads to a more serious follow-up. But it's your opponent in seeking the nomination of the Green Party for president is Roseanne Barr. And for our listeners, I'll say, yes, that Roseanne Barr. What's that been like?
It's been great. It's been wonderful. And I am, I'm delighted to have people like Roseanne turning to the Green Party. And, you know, Roseanne, who is a very respected voice of the working people and working women. So it's further confirmation that people of conscience out there are seeking another way forward. It's just not happening with corporate-sponsored political parties. So I welcome Roseanne to the fold. And, it's been wonderful. We are conducting different kinds of campaigns, and we have different objectives, and it's all working out very nicely.
Well, it seems to get at what I imagine is probably a bigger issue for the Green Party, and one of the things is, you know, you're both trying to fill in some pretty big shoes here, Ralph Nader, but it strikes me that there's a choice here between the two of you that, again, is a big question for the party, and it's, you know, do you go for celebrity and name recognition to get attention, or in your case, you know, more substance? So far, it seems like your party members are going for substance. Is this a conversation going on in the party, do you think?
As always, yes. It's an ongoing conversation. And I think it's, what should we say, it's validating, in my mind, the objectives of our run, which were to put forward real solutions that this party has developed over decades. We've been ahead of the curve. The curve has caught up to us. And people are very excited what our campaign is offering, which is real blueprints, real solutions that we've been working on in the field, in our communities. That is, jobs that really meet our needs for not only the environment but the economic and social needs of our communities, that put people to work in secure living wage jobs that are here for the long haul, that aren't going to be offshored and outsourced. It's about health care as a human right. It's about doing away with student debt and making public higher education free, as it should be, and bringing the troops home. We are very clear about what we're working towards and about building the Green Party as an organization for the long haul that fills that void of public interest politics that we just don't have right now.
And before we get to the three questions at the end, let me just ask you really briefly, for folks who want to find out more about the Green New Deal and other aspects of your campaign, where would you suggest they go?
Oh, so please come to our website. And I'm not just asking for your vote. I'm asking for your leadership in this campaign and our democracy. So come to jillstein.org. That's my name, Jill, JILLSTEIN.org, and join the team.
Okay, and now the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I think it's something like, "This is it, folks, now or never."
Second, what's your worst trait?
I stay up too late reading internet articles. I'm a news junkie.
And third, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
This one, practicing political medicine. I never would have dreamed it when I was in medical school and looking forward to a medical career. When people ask me what kind of medicine are you practicing, I say it's political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses. We got to fix that one in order to start fixing all the things that are broken that we can fix.
That was Dr. Jill Stein. Jill, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Grant. Been great being with you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.